This is Phil Ferrand.
And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I think it's episode 556. My notes say 555, but I think that was last week. This is 556. Not that I pay too much attention to these things, but, you know, it's good to put down a marker every once in a while. All is well. Everything seems to be puttering along with my major client. That all seems to be going fine. We've had a good, productive week. I went to the dentist this week and got my teeth cleaned. That was fun. I've started going to the dentist every 3 months now because I'm drinking more coffee because I'm doing the fasting for 48-hour fast a week. I think I've already talked about that. I really like it. I like it. But it does mean that on Monday I'm having 2 cups of coffee in the afternoon, the equivalent of 2 cups of coffee, plus 16 ounces, like 16.9 fluid ounces, and two cups of tea. And then on Tuesday, I'm having 4 cups of coffee and 2 cups of tea. And then on Wednesday, it's 2 and 2 again. And then on Thursday, it's 2 and 4 again. So it's a lot of coffee and a lot of tea. And, you know, over time, it adds up. Plus, I'm having coffee and, you know, same thing over the weekend. So a little bit of a ritual now. And I can tell when I don't have my coffee. I don't know if that means I'm addicted to caffeine now or what, but it's not too bad, but I can tell. So because of that, I'm just having my teeth cleaned every 3 months. And normally, when I was having my teeth cleaned every 6 months, it meant I had a new book to bring down, a new production copy of a book to bring down, because every 6 months I'd have a new production copy. Well, now at 3 months, it's like, so then I was trying to think, well, what can I do? Because I really like my dentist. She's so sweet. And I like all the people down at the dentist office. And they've been so good to me. And they were so good to my parents that it's just, you know, if I can do a little something, just a little something to say thank you, et cetera, et cetera. So I had been bringing them books. I will continue to bring them books. But this time I didn't have a book to bring. And so I thought, what am I going to do? Well, the last time I got my teeth cleaned, I had mentioned to my dental hygienist that International Dog Day was coming up. And that I was going to be in costume and that sort of thing. And she said, oh, can you come see us? And I was like, ah. But I was already going south for a few things anyways. And so I said, yeah, that's fine. She said, well, I'm not going to be here till like 1:45. I was like, okay, that's fine. So I did get down there. They hooped and hollered. That was the one with the poodle suit. And they hooped and hollered and we had fun. Et cetera. And they really enjoyed it. And because it's just so interesting. There is genuine joy there. It's not mocking. It's not criticism. It's not, you look weird. It's not, it's joy. It's real joy. It's just amazing. And so I thought, you know what? That's fine. I'll just do an extra crazy paisley day for them. So I had worn half of the stuff just under my clothes and wore a paisley shirt. I had several of the programmers swing by and said, wow, so paisley today. And I said, yeah, well, I said, it's going to be crazy paisley day for my dentist later. I didn't figure you all wanted me to show up in my Daisy Duke paisley shorts and work with my tights and stuff. So I said, I'm going to hold on that stuff until. So then just before I left headquarters yesterday, left like 15 minutes early and threw on the rest of the stuff and went down with my hat and my sunglasses and my 2 paisley shirts and my paisley undershirt and my paisley Daisy Duke shorts and my 2 pairs of paisley tights and my paisley shoes and my paisley socks and you know, they I wasn't sure at first because I walked into the dentist office and my hygienist was not who I expected it to be. And she was an older lady whom I had never met before. And she came out and she kind of looked at me and she was like, what in the world? And so, you know, I just started chatting her up and stuff. And then we were fine. By the time it was all said and done, we were fine. She had a big kick. And I was, you know, talking about the fact that I was working on a costume for Ugly Christmas. She said, oh, you need to come down and see us. So, I mean, by the time I was done, everything was fine. But yeah, that was kind of interesting. The other thing that was interesting was there was a man who was waiting in the waiting room as I was working, and I had just popped open my computer because I got there a little bit early, so I popped open my computer and I was just working, and, you know, I mean, working away. And, I mean, I'm very colorful in the paisley outfit and stuff, and it was, I had to kind of grin to myself because he was talking, and I was making some phone calls as well, but then I was working some more, and I came back in, sat down, started working my computer again a little bit, and he physically got up and sat in another chair facing away from me. It's like, well, okay. So, yeah. Apparently, he didn't want to keep staring at me. I don't know what he was staring at, but, you know, guys, you just need to lower your sperm counts, okay? But that's a whole other... That's a whole other topic. Anyways, so work is going well. I've officially started editing book 11 now. I've been this week putting in the stuff for book 11. I have two or three more books to put in stuff for, and the rest of it all just came in on PDFs. So I'm going to be exporting all the data files out of the PDFs and then reading them back into a master file. And then once I get that done, then I'll just start going through that and making the corrections on my Word file. And then I'll do my final read-through and then do a little tweaking on the cover and then get the production files in. And hopefully that happens before the Christmas break. And then I'll have Christmas break, have a few days off for Christmas, and then get back to book 12, and we'll start working on book 12 again. I did end up stopping a little bit short. I had some distractions over the weekend, and so I ended up at like 72,000 words, as opposed to 72.5, somewhere in there, as opposed to 75,000, but you know what? It's fine. It's fine. And some of that distraction was the fact that I was working on the Ugly Christmas sweater outfit based on a Christmas story. But that's okay. You know, we get the projects done one step at a time. We move forward. So it's all right. Everything will be fine. And once I get this thing built, I can just reuse it every year. So I'll probably get 2 to 3 years of use out of this. So Once it's built, I'm good. It's like the elf costume. This will be my third year with the elf costume, and come 2020, it'll be my third year with the leprechaun costume. So I just kind of keep adding to the repertoire. Did I mention this last week? Did I mention it? Rats. I don't know if I did or not. I'm trying to decide whether I should tell this story. I think maybe I mentioned it last week about the Dear Santa letter costume. I don't know. If I think of it, I'll go back and check and see if I mentioned this last week. And then maybe I'll talk about it next week. We'll see. Tomorrow is Dear Santa Letter Day. It's actually Dear Santa Letter Week, and it was actually last week. But since last Friday, I didn't know that, and I had my yearly one-day midlife crisis outfit, you know, next year I'll know. The second week of November is officially, if I have read my stuff correctly, is officially Dear Santa Letter Week. It's to encourage children to write letters to Santa, obviously. And so I found this really great t-shirt, made me laugh. And then I just happened to have this piece and that piece and, you know, ta-da! Which is an interesting thing. You wouldn't think, just on the surface of it, that Jesus would care about these crazy outfits, but in fact, there's these weird collusion of things that come together. So if I didn't share that story last week, I'll share it next week. I'll go check. Anyway, so that's fine doing that. And now we're in the run out because I have a t-shirt for not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow already, and know what I'm going to do for that. I have another t-shirt for the first week of December, and then the second week of December is ugly Christmas outfit. And the third week of December is Elf Day, and then, you know, I'm in the prep for Polka Dot Day, which is mid-January, and then also in the prep for Valentine's Day, since Valentine's Day is actually on a Friday in 2020. So once I saw that it was on a Friday, I was like, oh yeah, okay, you need to do something. Do something bigger. I actually found some mechanical wings for a reasonable price that I can kind of turn more steampunky. So I'm going to do that. So that should be fun. So yeah, fun stuff. This is just a little side projects. So writing's good, family's good, projects are good, work is good. 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 I am blessed. I am blessed. Been chatting with a friend from Walmart. He's in the midst of a big transition, in the midst of stuff that could potentially be disconcerting and overwhelming, and I've just been trying to encourage him. I wrote him yesterday, and, you know, 2 weeks, basically 9 days, 2 weeks from now, things will look different. He's not really sure how they'll look, and I was just trying to encourage him and say, you know what, step at a time, step at a time. Just listen real close, listen for him. Don't listen to all those voices in your head that are trying to tell him you're going to fail and it's going to be horrible. Just stay with Jesus, listen to Jesus. Try to keep yourself as quiet as possible because Jesus is already there 2 weeks from now. He's already there and he knows what's going to happen down there. And he's already making preparation for you, so you just have to move through these next 2 weeks. He's already there. So I'm going to bring him a book, Still Whispers, my Still Whispers book. I'm going to bring him that book next week, or tomorrow, and we'll chat some more. So, you know, step at a time. Step at a time. God is good, but just keep moving forward. So that's all good. It's all well. I came across an article. I had several other things kind of queued up for today, but I came across an article and it just happened to be about something that I was thinking about recently. And it kind of dovetailed in. And I won't do this article justice. I will tell you that right now. Because there is a ton of information in this article, a bunch of different theories, bunch of different suggestions and opinions, etc., etc. And I think I thought, well, I can just add my opinion to this because I have an opinion on everything. I can just add my opinion on it. But it is something that I've mentioned in passing, but I didn't quite tie it together like it tied together in my own mind, maybe. It is a phenomenon that I've noted several times on the podcast and I've kind of been keeping track of because I find it fascinating. The topic is the declining birth rates in industrialized countries. And not only industrialized countries, but birth rates are declining in various countries around the world, but nowhere as much as in the more industrialized countries, to the point where it is causing a fair level of concern because the population is not at a replenishment level. So the name of this article was The End of Babies. This was by Anna Louise Sussman. It came out on the 16th of November. And she has pulled together a tremendous amount of information. I won't get to it all. I won't do it all justice. It's a rather lengthy article, but it was pretty interesting. It was an interesting read. And so, you know, if you just look up the end of babies, you can go back right to the source, but I'm just going to hit some high points. So apparently, she starts off the article because apparently in 2015, there was a rash of posters, not just a rash appeared, but a rash of posters appeared around Copenhagen. This reminds me so much of the Philippines, because this is something like they would do in the Philippines, because the Filipinos, they live their lives right down on the dirt. I mean, they're very open about bodily functions. They're very earthy. Everything is fine. I've mentioned this before. Women breastfeed in public. It's no big deal. You know, men urinate in public. It's no big deal. At least they did when I was there. So apparently in the fall of 2015, there was a bunch of posters that showed up around Copenhagen. And one had an image of chicken eggs, and in pink letters over the top of those chicken eggs, it said, "Have you counted your eggs today?" And another one, tinted in blue, had a close-up of a human sperm. And the caption was, "Do they swim too slow?" Because apparently, the chairman of the Danish Fertility Society and one of the brains behind the campaigns believed this was an important issue. And even though they had gotten some criticism for it, and even though some people were kind of offended by this, because maybe you were equating women to farm animals, which I don't think they were doing that, but I could see how they could make the connection. The doctor that did this, Soren Zeeby, something like that, anyways, he thought that these kinds of messages, fraught as they are sorely needed because Denmark's fertility rate has been below the replacement level for decades. And he says, you know, the rate isn't solely the result of more people deliberately choosing childlessness. Many of his patients are older couple and single women who want a family but may have waited too long. Now, okay, in my mind, that classification, yes, they didn't deliberately choose childlessness, but they made a choice that they would delay childbearing and play the odds, which, okay, that's a decision, and everybody gets a right to make their own decisions, and that's fine if that's what they wanted to do. But sometimes everything doesn't work out exactly like you planned, so etc. That happens. So the writer of the article goes on to say, if any country should be stocked with babies, it is Denmark. The country is one of the wealthiest in Europe. New parents enjoy 12 months paid family leave and highly subsidized daycare. Women under the age of 40 can get state-funded in vitro fertilization. State-funded. But Denmark's fertility rate at 1.7 births per woman is roughly on par with that of the United States. A reproductive malaise has settled over this otherwise happy land. Now that's very interesting to me. The writer of the article goes on to say, it's not just Danes. Fertility rates have been dropping precipitously around the world for decades. In middle income countries, in some low-income countries, but perhaps most markedly in rich ones. Now that's very interesting. So the writer of the article goes on to then try to explain some of these things, that what does this mean, why would this be happening, etc., etc. And there's a whole bunch of theories that get floated. I obviously have my own theory because I have a theory on everything. But, you know, one of the things that the writer of this article says in regards to this is, at its worst, though, this decline reflects a profound failure of employers and governments to make parenting and work compatible, of our collective ability to solve the climate crisis so that children seem a rational prospect, of our increasingly unequal global economy. In these instances, having fewer children is less of a choice than the poignant context of unsavory, than the poignant consequence of a set of unsavory circumstances. So, according to that logic, then what's really happening is the fact that people are worried about having children. You know, they're worried about what will happen to their career when they have children. They're worried about what is happening in the world. And because of all those things, they are going to then make a choice not to have children. I'm getting my mail. One moment. And so what's really happening here is that people are making a rational choice to, let's see, that is not it. That is not it. I'm expecting something today. And I'm really hoping, hey, I think it came. Yay. Maybe. I think it came. Just a second. I want to I can't get it open. I'll do that later. So there's that. Now, she does go on to ask the question. She says, so something is stopping us from creating the families that we claim to want. Because she says that survey data, decades of survey data show that people's stated preference have shifted towards smaller families, but they also show that in country after another, actual fertility rates have fallen far faster than the notions of the ideal family size. In the United States, the gap between how many children people want and how many they have has widened to a 40-year high. In a report covering 28 countries, in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, women reported an average desired family size of 2.3 in 2016, and men wished for 2.2, but few hit their target. So, what is stopping people from hitting their target? So, she says in the article, there are many answers to this question, as there are people choosing whether to reproduce. At a national level, what demographers call underachieving fertility finds explanations ranging from glaring absence of family-friendly policies in the United States to gender equality in South Korea to high youth unemployment across Southern Europe. It has prompted concerns about public finances and workforce stability, in some cases contributed to rising xenophobia. Okay, because immigrants who are coming in were somewhat disadvantaged in work markets and those types of things are having babies. But according to the article, they're all missing the bigger picture. So one of the things they say might be causing this in the article is global capitalism. These social conditions economic conditions generate social conditions inimical to starting families. Our work weeks are longer, wages lower, leaving us less time to make money, court, and fall in love. Our increasingly winner-take-all economies require that children get intensive parenting and costly educations, creating rising anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. It seems clear that what we have come to think of as late capitalism, that is not just the economic system, but all its in attendant inequalities, indignities, and opportunities and absurdities, has become hostile to reproduction. So this is just another reason they would say we have to abandon capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole other section about people that's titled, I Have So Many Other Things I Want to Do. Parents say that, quote, children are the most important thing in my life, close quote, said Dr. Zeebe, father of two. By contrast, those who haven't tried it, who cannot imagine the shift in priorities that it produces nor fathom its rewards, see parenting as an unwelcome responsibility. Young people say, having children is the end of my life. Okay? So... you know, then they talk about other people who have waited and they almost have missed out on parenting. Imagine some managed to sneak in. She said there are those who have always sought to lay the blame for declining fertility in some way on women, for their individual selfishness in eschewing motherhood, or for their embrace of the feminist expansion of women's roles. But the instinct to explore life without children is not restricted to women. In Denmark, 1 out of 5 men will never become a parent, a figure that is similar in the United States. And then they have a bunch of examples, but one of them is Anders Krarup, is a 43-year-old software developer living in Copenhagen who recently rediscovered his love of fishing. Most weekends he drives to the Zealand coast, where he communes with the sea trout. When he's not working at his startup, he meets with friends for concerts as a family. As for a family, he's not particularly interested. I'm feeling very confident with my content with my life at the moment, he told me. We'll get back to all this in a minute. Okay. Another person said, I have so many other things I want to do. Then there's a quote in the article about an economist who studies population and points out that two rising features of modern life correlate with low fertility, rising workism, and declining religiosity. There is a desire for meaning-making in humans. This is a quote from Mr. Stone, who is Lineman Stone, an economist. But without religion, one way people seek external validation is through work, which when it comes to the dominant culture value is inherently fertility-reducing. In other words, if you are focused on work, then you don't have as much time, especially if you're trying to get ahead in work. You're trying to show your employees, your partners, your whatever, that you're dedicated. Then, you know, having children is a little more difficult. And it's happening in China as well. Now, China is an interesting case because China for decades, I think, enforced this one-child policy. And there was a lot of resistance to it at first. But then economies improve, there's more opportunities, people get used to the idea of just having one child. And then China, I think, released that one-child policy in 2015, I think. I'm in the middle of a documentary that I need to finish about the one-child policy and the effect it's had. So I'm not everything there, but... you know, Joyce Yuan, a 27-year-old Beijing-based interpreter who plans including earning an MBA outside of China. I still think I'm at the very beginning of my life, close quote. She cites, for instance, the high cost of urban living. Everything is super expensive, she said, and quality of life, especially in the cities, is extremely low. So she's looking at that and thinking, okay, how am I going to make more money? How am I going to care for children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The author goes on to say, my own experience as an American has been in some respects Danish, in others Chinese. I'm one of the lucky ones, thanks to scholarships and my mother's tremendous sacrifices. I graduated from college without debt. That's good. Thus unencumbered, I spent most of my 20s working and studying overseas. Along the way, I got 2 master's degrees and built a rewarding, if not especially remunerative, career. In my late 20s, I learned about egg freezing. Because my daughter has recounted the fact that when she got to 27, it was just like something said, okay, now, gotta make a baby. So in her late 20s, she learned about egg freezing. She said it seemed like a secret weapon I could use to stave off the decision of if and when to have kids, an absolution of sorts for spending these years abroad and not searching terribly hard for a partner. So at 34, I finally underwent the procedure. Last year, I did another round. Ever since then, there's a number that I've been playing with I've wondered about whether or not when I will use those eggs. According to my back of the envelope calculations, I should have $200,000 saved before having a child. And she goes on to say how she came by that number. And so that's, you know, that's interesting. So, you know, go on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's other concerns. There's a section of this called "This System of Value is Literally Going to Kill Us." So they said the solution, therefore, is not to compel a man like Anders Coppers to put aside his fishing and procreate, but nor to dissuade Liu Yuyu from pursuing her PhD. We must recognize how their decisions take place in a broader context shaped by the interrelated factors that can be hard to discern. Quote, the problem, to be clear, is not really one of population, a term that since its earlier use, according to the scholar Michael Murphy, has been a profoundly objectifying and dehumanizing way to discuss human life. Hundreds of thousands of babies are born on this planet every day. People all over the world have shown that they are willing to migrate to wealthier countries for jobs. Rather, the problem is the quiet human tragedies born of preventable constraints, an employer's indifference, a belated realization, a poisoned bodies that make the wanted child impossible. Sarah Matheson, a historian, George Washington University, whose forthcoming book examines family making in the post-Roe versus Wade era. So she says, quote, I see a lot of parallels between this tipping point that people feel in their intimate lives about around the question of reproduction under capitalism. Also played out in broader existential conversations about the fate of the planet under capitalism. It seems like more and more people are being pressed to this place of, okay, this system of value is literally going to kill us. So in other words, apparently part of the problem here is capitalism. And then they go on to discuss how part of the problem may be climate change and climate catastrophe. So the author of the article concludes all of this by saying the first step is renouncing the individualism celebrated by capitalism and recognize the interdependence that is essential for long-term survival. We depend on our water supply to be clean, and our rivers depend on us not to poison them. We ask our neighbors to watch our dogs or water our plants, offer help. We hire strangers to look after our children and aging parents and trust their compassion and confidence. We pay taxes and hope that those we elect spend that money to keep roads safe and open. These relationships between us and the natural world and one another testify to the interdependence that capitalistic logic would have us disavow. Okay. So reproduction is the ultimate nod to our interdependence. We depend on at least 2 people to make us possible. We gestate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And she wraps things up by saying, in that moment, I understood why I had frozen my eggs. Intellectually, I am skeptical, even critical, of the inherent narcissism of preserving one's own genetic material when they are already so many children without parents. Even as I was going through it, injecting drugs into my abdomen each night until it came to resemble a dartboard, I struggled to articulate why, at least in a way that made sense to me. But as I reflected on the immaterial gifts I like to think I inherited from my father, it became clear that I craved genetic continuity. however fictitious and tenuous it might be. I recognized then something precious and inexplicable in this yearning and glimpsed how devastating it might be to be unable to realize it. For the first time, I felt justified in my impulse to preserve some little piece of me that in some way contained a little piece of him, which one day might live again. Okay, and that's how the article concludes. So what's interesting to me about all of this? Is that when I look at the base subsystems, and I've mentioned this before, when I look at the base subsystems that are involved in this life, when and I look at the differences between men and women, people talk all the time about the reproductive strategies and the reproductive drives in men and women. And I just don't believe that men, in general, on average, have a reproductive drive. I think they have a reproductive function, but I don't think they have a reproductive drive. And I say that because without meaning to be crude, but, and I may have mentioned this on the podcast before, if men had a reproductive drive, they would care where they stuck it. And frankly, men don't care. They don't care. What they're looking for is that dopamine pop. And so there may be men, some men have a yearning to have children. There may be, but in general, on average, having children is just a kind of a side effect that comes along with chasing that dopamine pop. There is definitely in men an attraction, a targeting, if you will, of the opposite gender, on average in general, obviously, within a gay, homosexual approach to life, there is not as much targeting there. Although it's interesting to me that a lot of the costume designers that design very, what we would call sexy outfits, they seem to be well able to identify those things that are very alluring and appealing to men. Not that that's really difficult, but there does seem to be this ability to have men who are homosexual in their preference and their inclinations to be able to design things for a woman's body that are very appealing to heterosexual men. So there seems to still be some wiring down there. But certainly in men, there is a targeting. There is a targeting response down deep that draws us towards women, that draws us to certain shapes, that draws us to certain curvatures and symmetry, and draws us to getting it in the right place to create babies. But at the end of the day, you know, if men can have their dopamine pop, and that pretty much does it for us. So the fact that men would rather go fishing and they would rather do this and they would rather do that than necessarily father children is not surprising to me at all. And I would say that honestly, on average, in general, men are not driven towards getting married and making families. And you see this over and over in culture. Men are dating women. I mean, I think that my experience is somewhat typical in that, I was dating Lynette and we were dating and we were kind of dating. And, well, we were kind of hanging out. And Lynette finally got to the bed and she just said, "Look, can I? What are we? Are we dating? Are we," you know, there was this drive in her to move us forward to the next step. Where are we here? And I said, sure, you can tell people that we're dating. But it wasn't necessarily a drive within me. I was just like, well, if you want to tell them, that's fine. I know what this is. I was watching a video clip of Steve Harvey. And they were talking about this, you know, issue of, and they were asking men, they had all male audience and all females up on stage. And then there were questions, and then they polled the audience and they voted. And, you know, one of the questions that came up was, you know, why don't more, I don't know exactly the question, but basically it was, why don't more men want to date? Why are they just, you know, concerned to go along? And a woman is the one that's kind of pushing to get a commitment and pushing to, when are we going to get married, and pushing and pushing. And, you know, the men surveyed mostly came up with, it's just not that big of a deal to us. We're dating. I'm fine. You know, we'll work it out as we go. But there's more of an urgency. There's more of an urgency normally from the female side of that relationship than there is from the male side to make that commitment. So from the male side, if I look at the reproductive systems, I really don't see a reproductive drive. I see a reproductive function, and male men make a lot of sperm. And some of it happens to end up in the right place, and then we make babies. But men don't have this really great drive to use all their sperm to make babies. Okay. From the woman's side, from the female side, on average, in general, they do have a reproductive drive. There is a drive within women to become mothers. Now, the question is, where does that come from? And what is the primary driver underneath? Certainly, women have more oxytocin than men do. And oxytocin is the hugs hormone. It is that desire to be connected. And certainly, I think that does engender a desire for children. And as the woman was talking about at the end of the article, you know, she resonates with this idea of a genetic legacy. She resonates with this connection between her father and her children. She resonates with that idea. But I've mentioned on the podcast before that I think really what drives women through this process, because it's such a demanding process, and it's so fraught with potential difficulties, and it's fraught with pain and suffering and discomfort. And I mean, from, I don't know that experientially, but from what I can see, and from, I mean, it's just makes women miserable. But I think you have to have more than just that, like, bonding. I think there's got to be, at the base of it, it has to be driven by anxiety. And I think that what we could attribute the fact that men tends towards aggression and women tend towards neuroticism, when you're looking at the five big personality types, ocean, openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, aggressiveness, neuroticism. I don't use neuroticism in a derogatory term, but a clinical term, because that's what it's called in the big five personality types, that men tend towards aggressiveness, women tend towards neuroticism. That is a driver in this whole reproductive sphere, that what women are actually doing is they are building a nest, they are finding a husband, and that provides a layer of protection, plus it provides an inseminator, and then they can build another layer of protection using children. I grew up in a country where this was freely acknowledged, so I'm not saying anything derogatory about it. In the Philippines, when I was there, they would have huge families, 12, 15, 17 children. And the Filipinos would just tell you outright that the reason they were having that many kids is because some of them would die, but maybe one of these or two of these will grow up to be a doctor or a lawyer, and then they'll take care of the family. And it was just assumed in the Philippines, they're very family-oriented, that if you go overseas and you make money, well, of course you're going to send money back to the family. That's your responsibility. And so family very much was this bulwark that would take care of parents. And there are other countries in the world where this is very much in India. If you marry an Indian bride, on average, in general, you can just pretty much expect that her parents are going to come and live with you for at least a month out of the year, and you're going to pay all the expenses. That's the way it works. You get somebody like, what is her name? She's a Asian-American comedian. I think she's Chinese, I think. Ali Wong, I think. Her stuff is funny. Brutally honest. She talks about trapping her husband. She talks about popping out these babies, you know, because they're going to take care of her in her old age. I mean, it's just, this is part of, I think this is part and parcel. It's not all, but I think it's part and parcel of what drives women to have children is this anxiety and sense of danger in the world, and that helps relieve some of that a little bit. Well, now, so why in rich countries is the fertility rate dropping? Because I think in average, on average, in general, this is not condemning, it's just facts of life. I think women are the normal drivers for how many children to have and for when to have children. I have plenty of buddies that, you know, will say, yeah, my wife had more kids and we talked, but she really wanted to have more kids and, you know. And I think part of that is driven out from anxiety, whether it's acknowledged or not. Well, if you then create societies and you create emphasis that shift where the idea of safety is, if you shift enough and tell women enough that pursuing your own career is going to provide you much more safety, and if you go and apply yourself, you'll be able to climb the ranks, and you'll be able to make more money, and you'll be able to, then that relieves that anxiety just the same way that childbearing does. So why should I have children? Why not focus on my career? And again, I'm not blaming women for it. I just think it's a natural shift. That if you provide an environment that is safe, if you provide, or safer, if you provide an environment where women are upwardly mobile, if you provide an environment where their only option for protecting their future is not having children, if they have more options, then women will make those choices because having children is really hard. And that's perfectly understandable. And we have lived in a society, and in Western society and in richer countries, where all of this advertising is being pushed at women, and all of the images are of this successful businesswoman or this very attractive woman that's all put together and yada, 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 yada. And there's no continual stressing of, you know, look how beautiful these mothers are with their children, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you get a push, that the way you relieve your anxiety is to be successful. You know, the way you relieve your anxiety is to be beautiful. And all those things, you know, that in order to be successful, you have to buy all this stuff. All those things are advertising pushes. Then you reorient women just enough. You reorient women to say, so that their first line response in reducing anxiety about their place in the world is not necessarily building that nest with children, but it's building that nest on my own because I have those capabilities. That's not to say that's wrong. It's just a natural consequence. And so I think it makes perfect sense that in developed countries where women have more options, they birth fewer children. And since, in my mind at least, they are the primary drivers for when couples have children, you see the birth rates going down. I don't think this is hard. And you can blame it on capitalism, and you can blame it on climate change, and you can blame it on all these different things. But in many, many subtle ways, and in not so subtle ways, I think the driver underneath all this from a day-to-day perspective about how many children are born really comes down to the decisions that women make, and they are free to make whatever decisions they want. And certainly, there's an influence of free access to contraceptives. Certainly, there's an influence in making sex just some sort of a transactional thing as opposed to something that you use to get married. Certainly, there's an impact when you allow women to abort babies for no particular reason at all. All of that's going to impact your birth rate. And it's just the way it is. And so I'm not saying any of this to condemn anyone or saying that anyone should be doing this or should be doing that, but I don't think it's primarily capitalism. I don't think it's primarily global warming. I think primarily what's happening is there is a shift, a subtle underlying shift in rich countries away from where the primary source of safety and control is conceptually for women. And I think if anxiety is one of the things that is primarily driving the birth of children, the conception of children, then it makes perfect sense that if that anxiety is turned to other things for solutions, or even if there's a reducing of that anxiety, you would see automatically a reduction in birth rate. And I find that fascinating. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.